Okay, so in this section, we want to deal with the idea of structuring your home. And structuring it has to involve finances, structuring it financially so that you're able to homeschool. Now, I grew up, and when I grew up, my father worked at a job, and my mother stayed home, and she was in the home all day long. And that's what I grew up with, and when we got married, basically what I said was, well, that's the way we want to live, you know, and raise our children. So my wife worked when we were married, and she worked until she had the second child. You know, the first child was a year and a half old or something like that, and then we said, okay, we got to do it. We've got to structure it now. We've got to do it now, and so that's what we did. But I've learned quite a bit about economics, what I would say from a biblical perspective, in the meantime, and this is necessary to talk about, I think, because we've all been indoctrinated into a system of thought, and that we don't think biblically about the economics of the home. What does everyone tell young people about making your way in life? Okay, what's the thing? What do they tell? Well, they say to the littlest ones, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And they say, "Well, get a good education and get a good job." Everybody knows that's what you're supposed to do. And so this is the common knowledge on the street: get a good education and get a good job. Now, as far as getting a good education, what does that mean? Well, that means a good education as opposed to a bad education. The kind that you better be ready to pay big for. And say, but invest in yourself. Invest in yourself, you know. That means borrow money to pay teachers, quote unquote, so that you can begin your working career thousands of dollars in debt, but with a good education. Now, that never made any sense to me. I thought I was supposed to make money when I became 16, 18 years old, not pay money. Well, you know, you'll be further ahead if you pay a lot of money and get school loans and this kind of thing. And then ask the ones that with those useless degrees what field they are working in. You know, we did a Bible study on campus at Murray State University. I can tell you, coming out of college, that not more than 50% worked in the field of their major when they got their job. And somebody told me the other day that the figures are actually now about 30. You know, if you go 5-10 years out, it's about 30%, you know. So people go to school to study, you know, to get a good education. They don't end up working in the field that they studied anyway. Okay, so I couldn't wrap my mind around that. And another question you can ask them, so when were your school loans paid off? How old were you when your school loans were paid off? In this kind of thinking, get the good education side of the thing. So remember, Proverbs 22:7, the rich ruleth over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. You know, and if in 5 years you can amass $100,000 in debt for an education, in 5 years at the most menial job, you can make $100,000. That's only $20,000 a year. So you're realistically more like $250,000 to $500,000 ahead. Just going to work. At least it seemed to me that way. On the other side of things, I have trouble with the idea, get a good job, get a good education, get a good job. Good education you got to pay for and get school loans. The good job thing, you know, when I started looking at Scripture, that didn't match up either. So I'm thinking of Malachi 4, verses 1 to 4. Now this is the kind of a This is a prophetic text. The prophets are portraying the blessings of the reign of the Lord Jesus Christ, what it looks like, what Christ's blessing to his people will look like. For behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, and all that do wickedly shall be stubble. The day that cometh shall burn them up, saith the Lord of hosts, that it shall not shall leave them neither root nor branch. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise, with healing in his wings. And ye shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall. And ye shall tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet. In the day that I shall do this, saith the Lord of hosts. Remember ye the law of Moses. Oh, I'm in the wrong text. Sorry. That was a good one. I said Malachi. It's Micah. Micah 4. Wonder didn't get where I wanted. But in the last days it shall come to pass that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow unto it. And many nations shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For the law shall go forth of Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he shall judge among many people, and rebuke strong nations afar off. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. But they shall sit every man under his vine, and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts hath spoken it. Now, it's interesting to me that when God portrays the blessing of his people, he portrays it in these terms. Every man sits under his own vine, the thing that he owns, and his own fig tree, a vine that he prunes and a fig tree that he prunes, vine that he eats the fruit of and a fig tree that he eats the fruit of. And so it seems to me that man is portrayed not as someone working in a good job. He's portrayed as owning the thing that he reclines under and enjoys the fruit of. And if I had to put that in economic terms, I'd say, it seems to me this guy owns his own business. And that goes all the way back again to one of the experiences that I had in life as a young man. And I was interested in this girl one time, and her father was a vice president of a bank, and of course the parents then were serious about me, so they sat me down. Now, I thought, man, these people really, this is a beautiful house that they live in, and they have nice cars, and they have everything that I thought I wanted as a 16-year-old, you know, or 18-year-old, whatever, however old I was, you know, and, you know, so I was all ears when they sat me down, and she said, she did the talking that night. She said, you know, Irv has done really well, and we're very pleased with what we have and so on. But, you know, if we had to do it again, we would own our own business. Now, I was probably 18, 19, maybe. That clicked with me. I understood perfectly at that one time. You didn't have to say it a second time. You didn't have to say it a third time. I didn't have to hear it again. I understood perfectly what she was saying and what I needed to do, what my goal was, what my goal became in life. Now, that was really before I was a Christian. But I understood what I was being told. You're the vice president of the bank's telling you. He looks at all the financial statements of these people that come and borrow money, and they're all better off than he is, and he wishes he had owned his own business. And that's saying that's where the money is. That's where you want to have the productive life. You want to own your own business. I heard that from this woman that sat me down that night. But I came to understand it from the scripture, that when the scripture portrays these things, it portrays men in certain economic conditions, and business ownership is at the top of the rung. The top of the ladder. So it's not get a good job and somebody's going to give you the opportunity to
to climb the corporate ladder and push everybody else down, but you'll get up there and we're going to fight to the top, and somehow then they're going to give us a good salary.
Okay? It's none of that. It's own your own business. Sit under your own vine, under your own fig tree. That's God's portrayal. R.L. Dabney, in his Defense of Virginia in the South, points out that the job, the employee, biblically speaking, is the bottom of the economic scale. In other words, if you had to structure economically, biblically now, who's at the top of the economic scale? The business owner is at the top. He in Scripture is called the householder, or the master. You know, those are names that are used, householder, master. The English called him the free man. He's at the top of the economic scale. Okay, second in order under the householder is the servant, who generally speaking is a bond servant. We call him a slave. Okay, so you got the householder, and then the slave, and then below him, below the slave, is the employee. And he, biblically, is called the hireling, or hired servant. And so that's a huge shift in our economic thinking. But this is the Old South now. This is R.L. Dabney, you know, and he builds that on the basis of the prodigal son. You know, the prodigal son left the householder, said, "Give me my inheritance. I'm going to make my way now. I'm ready. I'm not going to work with you and in your thing. I'm going to go out and do my own thing. Give me my inheritance." And of course, when he finds himself feeding the swine and would have eaten the swine food, he is humbled at that point, and he repents, and he says, "I'm going to go to my father's house," because why? And you've got to stop and say, okay, so what position was he ready to take at his father's house, in his father's house? The lowest. What did he say? "How many of my father's hired servants have food enough to eat?" So in his repentance, he was ready to go home and take the lowest position, which is the hired servant. So structurally, when you think about this, now, you know, of course, so it's the householder, biblically speaking, then it's the slave, and then it's the hired servant. And that's our economic scale of positions that we ought to think about. And just one point on the slave, on the bond, even the bond servant, okay? The bond servant's got a pretty good deal. I've thought about disguising this and seeing how many people would sign up for it. Okay? I know they would. Okay, so here's the deal. Here's the deal I'm offering. Okay? I am contracting for you for all your future labor, all your life. Till you're 65 years old, maybe even beyond, but until you can't work anymore, I want all of your labor. I'm ready to buy it. Now, I'm going to give you a place to live. I'm going to give you health care. I'm going to give you retirement, food. I'm going to give you everything you need, tools, food, everything. You got a whole package. I'm providing everything for you, and you're going to have cash to spend. Okay? And that's the deal.
Retirement plan.
I said retirement. Retirement, health care, place to live, food, and I will never lay you off. Promise. You'll never be laid off. Even if you get sick, you'll be taken care of. You don't have to worry. That's the deal. That's what a slave has. The bondservant has that. The hireling.
Tenured school teacher.
A tenured school teacher. Well, maybe he's close. The hireling. "Hey, I'm done. You know, job's done. Thanks. You know, you did a good job. We're really happy. Next time we have some work, you know." But you shift for yourself now. Now, is the hireling closer to the householder? Oh, maybe. Maybe he's going to develop capital and do good and save up and
later on in life he'll be able to be a householder and even have his own.
So a lot of the black men in the South, some of them were freed slaves that had slaves themselves, you know, and they had one guy, I forget, he had 100 servants, you know, that he had bought, you know, he's made his way, did well. Okay, so the hireling is in one sense closer to that. But Abraham's bondservant was also close to it too. In other words, the scripture tells us that he that bringeth up a servant tenderly from a child will have him as his son. And he will have inheritance among the brethren. And that means that the position of being a bondservant in a household merges itself into sonship and sometimes ownership. Abraham, when God said you're going to have children, he said, no, so I don't have any children. God promised him, he said, I don't have any children. The steward of my house is Eleazar of Damascus is my heir. So the bondservant stood to inherit all that Abraham had. Okay? And that's just to say we don't think economically, biblically, anymore because we've been told, well, get a good job and get a good education. Or get a good education and get a good job. And the idea is a job by pleasing someone else that somehow they're going to decide to give you this big position where it's a big salary and it's, you know, I'm well off, you know, and this kind of thing. Okay, so that doesn't add up. This narrative everyone knows is wisdom, the common wisdom on the street, ultimately teaches us to aim at the lowest position, the job. Now, I'm not saying jobs are bad. I mean, people need jobs. If you said, look, we're going to have totally a biblical society, I don't know what percentage of the people would be householders, what percentage would be bondservants, what percentage would be hirelings. I can't really say. I like to think 50% or 60% might be householders. You know, it might be hard to find employees. No, I'd like to think that. I don't know what the percentages are. I suppose it has to do with the morality of the society and so on and so forth. So I recognize not everybody can own their own business. I'm just saying, what are we teaching our kids to aim at? When we say, get a good education and get a good... You're telling them, aim at the lowest level possible. That's something's wrong with that. Okay, there's another problem here, and this I hope to illustrate clearly too. Next to that is a system. Okay, so what we got? How do we develop economically in our family? The goal is making money. We have to make money. That's the economic goal of the family, and that is to say, all your productive effort needs to be converted to Federal Reserve notes, pieces of paper, and then bestowed on whoever has the goods you want. So what you do is you take all of your activity and you turn it into paper notes, and then you give those notes for everything that you want and need in life, and that's the economic approach that people take. Now, I would like the monopoly. I would take it if it was offered me to print money and make everyone else use it. What a deal. Do you realize what, if I could print the money and make you use it, what a deal I would have? I would be the kingpin. I'd be the guy to see. And my money, like your money, like our money, comes with a tremendous handling charge. If you want a Federal Reserve note, there's an income tax on every Federal Reserve note you earn. And there's a sales tax on everything you bestow that Federal Reserve note on to gain for yourself. Not only that, the goods you purchased were taxed too. There was a corporation, somebody made those things, and that was taxed, and their profits were taxed. And so there's a sales tax. Every dollar that's the goods you purchase made by someone else who paid their taxes on property and equipment as well as on their profits. Can you project what the actual value of all of this is? Your income tax, sales tax, their property tax, their income tax, taxes on their equipment, their personal property tax or whatever. I mean, it's got to be 50 cents on the dollar at least, in my estimation. So I'm saying this is a costly system to deal in. And then they keep printing more money. So you can't hold the dollar. Okay, let's say you in 1932 held a U.S. dollar. What's it worth today? You can't hold it. It's musical chairs. Because the guy that has the monopoly, remember I was signing up for that, I want the monopoly to print the money. The guy that has the monopoly keeps printing more Federal Reserve notes. He gets to spend them free of cost, and then the Federal Reserve notes are all chasing the same amount of goods, so the goods go up in price. Okay? And that's sort of how it works. I mean, there's a lot more to it than that, but to simplify it, that's the problem of dealing with Federal Reserve notes. And so that's the deal. Now, I've come to recognize, and again, I think this is biblical, that economics doesn't mean cash. Okay? This strikes at the very heart of homeschooling. So. Economics doesn't mean cash. What I do for myself, they can't tax. And it's 50 cents on the dollar, more than that. What I do for myself, they can't tax. So I ask myself, how much can I do for myself? That's kind of a challenge. How much can I do for myself? The old farmers used to talk about having, quote unquote, a cash crop. Now, what that means is the kind of farming they did, they had animals, they raised food to feed the animals, they raised beef to eat, they raised chickens, they got the eggs, they ate the chickens. They raised hogs, and they did so. They raised their own food. They raised field crops in order to feed the animals who were producing the food that they were going to eat. They might have sold some animals and things like that as well. But they had something they called a cash crop, and that was a crop that they were raising not to feed to the animals and not to eat to themselves, but to sell so they could pay their taxes and have some cash to do the other things that they did. But again, think of the mentality of this. The amount of cash that I need is not my whole economic picture. The amount of cash that I need is this segregated thing over here that I can't do for myself. I can't say, well, I'll chop wood, when tax time comes. I got to have cash to pay it, So you think in economic terms here. You're dividing your productive labor in what I can do for myself, which has no carrying fee. You don't pay taxes on the dollar, on the time that you chopped your wood or collected eggs from the chickens or raised that hog or that beef cattle or whatever. You don't pay taxes on any of the time, on any of the economic effort you spent to do those things. You only pay tax on the Federal Reserve notes that you're spending as part of the economic package that is out there. So that's what my attitude towards this thing. I've come to recognize that economics doesn't mean cash. What I can do for myself, they can't tax. How much can I do for myself? Now, your home is where the rest of the economics lies. Okay, let that sink in. Your home is where the rest, the non-cash economics, lies in your home. And that's, I think, the way that we can begin to view things when we think about homeschooling. Children can do economic things that are productive. They can feed chickens, raise chickens. They can collect eggs. They can learn. Some of the girls can show you how to slaughter chickens, you know, and eat. So you get to eat them, but you don't have to know how to cut them up. And it's then there's stories to tell about them running around without heads or the cone deal that you got, you know, so you don't have to do that, chase them around. Okay, so let's look at the Bible's presentation of this issue, and I'm going to turn to Proverbs 31. And again, notice the connection with the home, because it's the wife who is central to this thing. In the counter-economics, or in the economics that don't necessarily involve what the husband does, be he householder, or be he hireling, or be he bondservant, it doesn't matter, because the other side of the economic picture is in the home. So Proverbs 31, beginning at verse 10, who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her, so that he shall have no need of spoil. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeketh wool and flax, and worketh willingly with her hands. She is like the merchant's ship. She bringeth her food from afar. She riseth also while it is yet night, and giveth meat to her household, and a portion to her maidens. She considereth a field, and buyeth it. With the fruit of her hands she planteth a vineyard. She girdeth her loins with strength, and strengtheneth her arms. She perceiveth that her merchandise is good. Her candle goeth not out by night. She layeth her hands to the spindle, and her hands hold the distaff. She stretcheth out her hand to the poor, yea, she reacheth forth her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. She maketh herself coverings of tapestry. Her clothing is silk and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sitteth among the elders of the land. She maketh fine linen and selleth it, and delivereth girdles unto the merchant. Strength and honor are her clothing, and she shall rejoice in time to come. She openeth her mouth with wisdom, and in her tongue is the law of kindness. She looketh well to the ways of her household, and eateth not the bread of idleness. Her children arise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and praiseth her. Many daughters have done virtuously, but thou excellest them all. Favor is deceitful, and beauty is vain. But a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. Now that's God's portrayal of the other side of economics, what grows out of the home. And economically, this is what grows out of homeschooling, because there's time and there's the ability to do all these things with the children who are being raised and learning. See, there's where their education lies. They're learning in the doing of the thing that is the economic pursuit of the home. And so, again, you know, I want to encourage you in that to say, okay, so let's rethink the economics here. Let's think differently than the cash system. Now, this comes right to the forefront of a two-income family that is saying, how do we homeschool? You know, how can we do this? How can we give up half of our Federal Reserve notes and come home and teach children? But it's also, so understanding that there is economics in the home that transcend Federal Reserve notes, so it's about things you can do for yourself in feeding yourself. Now, you know, that means some sort of agricultural aspect. Yeah, but men were agriculturalists for thousands of years, you know, before the modern age of industrialization. You know, so I guess you got to think about chickens and pigs maybe or something like that. But, you know, but there are other things. The Proverbs woman involved in textiles. That's the word for sewing. You know, cloth, wool, spindle, and distaff. The spindle is the spinning wheel, right? Distaff? Is that weaving, or is that still an aspect of the spinning wheel? I'm not sure. Okay, but you understand that there's economic activity going on in the home. Now, the challenge then is, so how can I make that work? How can I think about that? You know, instead of saying, okay, I got to have two incomes and pay cash for everything, how can I say, I only need a cash crop, I only need a cash pursuit over here because there's an economic activity growing up in my home that involves my children where they're able to learn and do things, and it's an aspect of their education. See, that's what I'm presenting to you as part of the solution. So a woman, the home is a productive institution. I say that all the time. The woman can be at home and be productive. Children can participate in economic activities that are of benefit to the family. Eggs from your chickens, you know, is a great example. I won't mention names. So we went to dinner at a family's home, and the woman said, "So tonight's dinner is everything that we've grown in our garden or raised with our animals or whatever." So it was and we've been there as well. We've sat down at a meal and said, everything on the table is something we've made, is something we've grown. Okay? And that there's something about that. Yeah. This is prosperity. This is what we've accomplished. So when we ask how can I homeschool? And that's the question we're trying to answer. The answer is rethink your economics. Get out of a cash mindset. Bring mother home. Plant a garden. Raise chickens. You might learn to butcher them. And then maybe that's not what everybody can do immediately. That's what you aim at. So there are work-at-home opportunities in some fields, depending on what your field is. You know, with computers, some folks are doing all kinds of things from home by the computer, medical coding and other things. So you've got to be creative. There may need to be an area of transition between the two cash, you know, economy of the home and, you know, the rural agriculture things that you can do in homeschooling with your kids. Okay, it might need to be part-time, evening work, computer work, other things like that. You could be creative. So I'll tell you what we did and what has happened, okay? So when we made the decision that my wife was going to be at home, we both worked for the airlines at this time, okay? When we made the decision she was coming home, going to be a mother at home with the children, you know, I had this view. So let's talk about, you know, a garden. Let's talk about planting a garden and things like that. And one of the things that she was interested in was baking. She said, you know, I'd like to bake bread, because we are also living in an Amish community, in an area with a lot of Amish. And she'd see these Amish women baking bread and be in the house, you know, and they'd have bread in there. And she was interested in it when she was a young girl. And so she said, I'm going to learn to bake bread. Well, baking bread is not a science. It's an art. Okay, so you can have the directions there and have all the ingredients right, and still the thing is a piece of junk when it's all done, okay? So the process of learning to bake bread means that you eat a lot of junk before it's really perfected, you know, but the ability to perfect. But she, nevertheless, we persisted. We ate it. And a loaf of bread, you know, with the ingredients costs about 33 cents. Still, about 35 cents or something like that if it's white bread. You know, so it was economically an advantage, and it's nice to have fresh bread. It's much better than anything. So, well, you know, and then as she did that and became good, then it was profitable, and we started thinking about doing farmers markets. And today, we've been doing farmers markets for over 20 years. You know, it's a full-time thing of sorts. We built a 1,500 square foot bakery on our farm, and we produce bread. You know, I slice 700 loaves of bread, something like that, on a Friday that we're sending out to the markets, wherever it is we're going to the farmers markets. So the little thing that we did in our homeschooling and is part of that package of counter-economics, non-cash economics in the home, has turned into a business, you know, and it's profitable, you know, profitable enough that we built the building on our property, you know. And so these are the kinds of things that open up in the providence of God when you do something. Just do something, okay? Just begin. Make up your mind you're going to do it, and you begin. And then by the grace of God, these kinds of things open up to you, and you have to know, and you can capitalize on them as you will. Okay, another point is get out of debt and get out of the debt payment mind. There's a mindset here where these guys, the young people, when they say, I need a new car, and she says, well, I don't want an old rickety thing, and he says, well, you know, a new car won't, you know, will be better because it won't break down. Okay, all right, I hear it. Okay, so that's the justification, and so they don't ask how much is the new car. The new car is $35,000, and he makes $33,000 a year. He's talking about taking an entire year's productive labor and putting in this piece of metal and upholstery that at the end of the period of time, when he's actually paid the thing off with interest, well, now it's 0% now. They jacked the price up about $5,000. It's $40,000 now, 0% interest. The end of the period of time when it finally is paid off, because it's financed, it's just nothing but an old rickety car that he would say, well, it might break down. Okay, so, you know, I build homes. One of the things I did in life was to build homes as well. I counsel people for financing. I know how to get them financed for a home. You know, and I know what the banks are looking for and all this kind of thing. I sit down with these people all the time. Two car payments. $400 a month on this one, $400 a month on that one. They owe $16,000 here and $8,000 here. Two jobs, two car payments. Okay. Well, you know, one job, one cash thing, maybe no car payments. Think about that. Think about, if you have to, sell the car. I'm telling you, if you want a running vehicle, I'll get you a Dodge Caravan. Okay. It's a 300,000 mile vehicle. All you got to do is a maintenance on the thing. Once in a while, you get into something. Oh well, that's another thing. I learned to fix my own stuff. You know, I came up with this thing. I can't quite get there, but I like to say it this way: I don't operate something I can't fix. Right? This is the mindset of the independent man. You know, why would I operate something I can't fix? Now, I suppose an airplane pilot can't exactly say that. He has an idea of how the maintenance works and so on and so forth. And there are things he does in the cockpit in an emergency or in a bad situation. He jiggles that wire. He gets in there. He talks to maintenance. Okay, try this, try that. All right. So it's not absolute, but with the home, I don't operate anything I can't fix. I fix appliances. I fix refrigerator. I got a washer that I've had apart 3 times. I've got a dryer that I've had apart 4 times. A refrigerator, and then when that evaporator unit goes out, when your evaporator unit goes out in the back of your refrigerator, get the whole thing that comes with this, the diode to the controls. 3 or 4 times I changed the coil before I changed the whole diode thing. It was the diode throwing the coil out. Okay. So these are the kinds of things. So I learned. Now, I was not schooled in any of it. I learned to do it. All right, maybe I have high mechanical aptitude. Maybe you do too. Some of the women do. Okay. And some of the men. But the idea is, I don't want to call a serviceman. There's YouTube. YouTube will show you. And if you get one of these guys that doesn't know, there's this one guy that's got his 6-year-old daughter showing you how to work on a Dodge Caravan. It's called Isabel Knows. Okay, so it's a 6-year-old, and she's telling you, block it up now, do this, put the parking brake on now. Here's how you change the radiator. He's helping her. But it's a cute video. You know, if a 6-year-old can do it, I think your husband can do it. I think you can do it. Okay? So get out of the mindset, I call the serviceman. I do call servicemen as a last resort. Okay? And the one I called a serviceman this week on a bakery oven. He's in Memphis. He didn't want to come up. I didn't really want him to come up, but I'm talking to him about it. I said, okay, here's what it's doing. It's popping. It's almost like it's not igniting right. Now, what's in the thing? Is there an igniter or, you know, is there a coil? You know, I know it's got electronic ignition. I have that part. I have an extra one of them. But he says, nah. He says, let me think about it. He talked to them, the Baxter people. He called me back. He said, you know, just go in and clean it and see if that solves the problem. He says, sometimes you get a little bit of a crust on the flame sensor, and it's not picking up the fact that there's a flame, and so it starts and it shuts off, and it won't start. You know, it's just not telling that there's a flame. So clean it real good and see if that solves. Okay, so that's me talking to a serviceman, and I crawl in the oven and clean the thing. And, you know, there's a lot of this you can do yourself. It's not rocket science. Okay, and again, that's with the mentality that my home is a productive institution. I produce something. See, that's the language of our world is, what are you? You're a consumer. Well, I'm not a consumer. I'm a producer. I'm a consumer in Europe. And why is it? Because all you people are consumers. And all us industries are producers. So where do they get off defining me as a consumer? I produce more than they do, per capita. Okay, they're not slicing 700 loaves of bread on a Friday. They're sitting at their computers punching keys. Okay, so you see what I'm saying? So the whole mindset is a change in mindset. You can do it with your home. Okay, so work on your cars. Teach your sons to work on your cars. You know, I see people get, I got to have a brake job done on my car. And if they got a quote from somebody in town, $1,000, $1,200 for a brake job. And I look at these things and I just can't believe it, you know, because $39.95 is a Duralast gold brake pads, you know. And you can get rotors for $49 if you need front rotors. You usually don't need rear rotors. You know, rear pads might be $29. So I can't come up with $250 worth of brake parts to put on a vehicle most of the time, unless it's some exotic thing. But if brakes are a mystery to you, you know, now drum brakes are a little harder because they don't, you know, but there's not many of those around anymore. So you see what I'm saying? It's more, and I'm just using illustrations to say it's more of a what can I do for myself mentality. But that's what Deuteronomy 6 was talking about when it said, these commandments I command you, teach them diligently to your children when you lie down, when you rise up, when you walk by the way. Okay, when you're doing that brake job, you know, and you're putting the new pads on the vehicle, you say, you know, son, and he's right there looking over your shoulder. You say, you know, son, we really ought to check the slides on these things and make sure that these things are gliding properly. You know, what happens if you have a brake caliper and it doesn't center itself on the rotor? You wear out one side of the pad more than the other, and you can tell that sometimes when you pull it apart. So, you know, the slides needed lubricating. because they weren't really centering themselves right. One side is worn out more than another side. But it's an aspect of diligence that you're teaching your child. And you say, look, we're going to take the time now and pull these slides out and clean them up and lubricate them before we put this thing back together. We're going to be careful in the way that we do the job. And that's just an aspect of, it's a morality of work that you're teaching your child as you do this thing with him. Again, it involves children in very practical work that's useful and it's interesting. And you will find one kid loves to do the breaks and another kid hates it. You know, one kid runs away when you try to do something. The other kid's right there pouring over it. I won't. Can I brag on? I had a 6-year-old. I couldn't believe the way the boy worked. He worked like an 11-year-old. 6-year-old grandson. It's unbelievable. It's fun. See? Put up your cell phones and your computer games and actually work for yourself, and a new world opens up to you. And new opportunities open up for you and for your children. And I'll say one more point on this thing. So we have this bakery business. I do the farmer's market. You know, I'm in Murray, Kentucky. My wife's in Jackson. So out on the square, on the court square in Murray, you know, if it wasn't this year, you know, last year at this time, we'd probably have 50 vendors that are out there with all kinds of products that they're selling, with all kinds of backgrounds going into the selling of these products. Okay, some of the vendors there are doing exactly the thing that I'm talking about. It's a cottage industry in the home. They make soap. And they're out there on the square selling the soap that they've made. And over a period of time, they develop a clientele so that whatever their sales level is, if it's $300 worth of soap on a Saturday that they sell $300 worth of soap every Saturday. But and that soap that they made in their home, a soap you make has glycerin in it. It's much better than anything you'll buy in the store. Okay, but that's what came out of their home. There are people selling eggs that are doing that. There are people that have textiles and sew, that crochet, that knit. You know, there's a whole variety of these kinds of things, and the stuff is out there already. And all I'm saying to you is, when you think about homeschooling, when you think about the ability to homeschool, I'm giving you, trying to give you illustration after illustration of how to get out of the Federal Reserve note cash mindset. So that you're not looking at this as the loss of an income. You're looking at this as the partitioning of your own family economics. I partition this. I need cash for certain things. That's my cash partition. It may be all the husband's efforts are a cash crop to the family. But back on the other side of that, the family's productive and making things, doing things. And learning in the process of doing those things. If you're going to make soap, there's math involved in it. There's science involved in it. You know, you must procure things. There's purchasing. You must balance the books. You know, there's accounting. There's all kinds of things that open up to you on some little economic endeavor that comes out of this kind of a mindset. And so, again, when you ask how I homeschool, you have to begin with the economic mindset that makes it possible. And it's going to mean, yes, it's going to mean certain decisions. No, don't finance cars. By all means, don't finance. Don't pay a loan on a car. You know, you can buy a almost beautiful car. These cars will go... Dodge truck will go 1,000,000 miles. You can buy a beautiful car with 100,000 miles on it. You know, body-wise, it's nice and all this kind of thing. For pennies on the dollar. 10% of its original cost. I mean, so again, that's the economic mindset that's necessary to do this thing. And then, so we're going to break. I'll take questions for a minute, and then we're going to break, and then we're going to come back to, again, the practical aspects. Okay, so what about the actual job of teaching a curriculum to children? And so we'll get down to that. But does anybody have questions or are there comments on any of that, Ben?
Notice the Proverbs 31 woman owns tools and buys two things that are mentioned, commodities and income-producing assets.
Yes, commodities and income-producing assets. And her husband gives her the fruit of her hands. Okay, she's got the productive labor going on in the home. He doesn't say, I need $50 for the light bill this week. You know, so give her the fruit of her hands. And so her economic endeavors are hers to expend. She reinvests. She expands the productive institution. So, you know, more so, see, we don't know what the man in Proverbs 31 does. He may have 10 servants as well, and he may have flocks of sheep or something like that. Or he may be a hireling, you know, working for someone else. But whatever it is, her economic endeavors, which involve her children arise and call her blessed. Her economic endeavors that involve the children are hers to manage. So she has to be a capable manager, you know, in instructing them and showing them in working these economics out in the home. And now I'm not suggesting that she's 18 years old and has twin babies that are her first kids. You know, I think she's probably more mature in the process of this, because she's the snapshot of the Proverbs 31 woman is taken at some time. And I'd say she's probably mature, but she's been doing this stuff throughout her adult life. She's working to this as an end. Okay? So. Anybody else? So we'll take another 10 minutes and then try to do a couple practical things.